murals.
Well, what's going to be interesting today, as I kind of told you before we were talking, this really kind of gives you the, I don't want to say confirms, but it gives you the feeling that this was actually early on in Israel's history. But when most people believe Samuel put the book together, when Samuel put it together, he put this as the at the end to kind of show how, you know, far Israel had fallen. But actually, if this is early in their timeline, then they fell really, really quick and were capable of really, really bad things. So I guess I'll just start with verse 1. So it says, then all Israel from Dan to Beersheba and from the land of Gilead came together as one and assembled before the Lord in Mizpah. Mizpah means watchtower. And so what's interesting is this is the first time in this narrative of the book of Judges that Israel has come together as one and there is no judge, which kind of leads you to believe that it's early in the beginning, like we were talking this morning, like the residuals are left over from Joshua and all the tribes working together, that they can come together as one. As you see, some cases in the book are very, very limited and are very, very regional, and other tribes aren't included and they're mad, or other tribes don't show up and people are mad because they didn't show up, but here kind of everybody shows up. So the leaders of all the people of the tribes of Israel took their places in the assembly of God's people, 400,000 men armed with swords. So obviously, and this also gives you a feeling, there's a lot of times in the book where they don't have any weapons. They're fighting with implements because they've been conquered, and the first thing people do when you're conquered is take away your ability to fight back. And so you get the feeling that this is early in their history and that they all have swords. And 400,000 people is a pretty decent-sized army. So the Benjamites heard that the Israelites had gone up to Mizpah. So the Benjamites, who obviously, to go back last week, we had the kind of almost the Sodom and Gomorrah-type incident where and it happened in the land of Benjamin in one city. And so now, which is kind of because it says, then from all of Israel came people together. So I was kind of like, does this give you the feeling that some of the Benjamites came there and were with the other group? Or, you know, again, it's kind of, we're used to dealing with, you say, well, York County's going to fight with Adams County or Harper County. Well, these are all people, everybody's related. So these are all your cousins and your second cousins and your third cousins and your sister that's married to your cousin. And so it's a very, very close-knit thing. So continue in verse 3. Then the Israelites said, tell us how this awful thing happened. So I find the Levites, and he was corrupt, obviously, and kind of a coward. And although, I mean, that's kind of easy to say, you're not there facing a whole city's worth of crazy guys wanting to have sex with you. So the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, I and my concubine came to Gibeah and Benjamin to spend the night. During the night, the men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house, intended to kill me. They raped my concubine and she died. So I'm assuming that his servants there and a couple other people, because again, you know, God said you have to have two witnesses before a thing can be established. But I think it's kind of interesting here that he never doesn't make himself look as bad as the real narrative, like that he offered to throw his concubine out there, you know, if you'll just leave me alone. He kind of skips over all that and says, you know, he doesn't say I threw her out there. It says they raped my concubine. So and she died. He doesn't talk about how she made it to the, we were talking this morning, made it to the threshold of the house. And there's a thing called a threshold covenant in that civilization or whatever your culture that says, once I cross the threshold, once I touch your threshold, I have the protection of your house. So if you remember at the end of the narrative, when they found her in the morning, she had her hand on the threshold. And I think part of that is it brings condemnation on that house that, you know, they did. So, because you never hear about the old man who tried to do a good thing. He's kind of gone from the narrative now, so I don't know how that works out. So then it says, I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and outrageous act in Israel. Again, I'm assuming one of the pieces went to the Benjamites. So, and then he says, now all Israel, speak up and tell me what you have decided to do. All the men rose up together as one, saying, none of us will go home. No, not one of us will return to his house. So they're basically saying, look, we have 400,000 people here with swords. There's no sense of us going home and trying to reorganize or decide what to do. We're staying here. We're going to deal with this now. And so it said, but now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it in order decided by casting lots. I kind of found that interesting that they were kind of casting lots, which that's not, you know, how God had decided to. But before they do that, they actually go speak to God, if you will, go before God. So, and then it says, we'll take 10 men out of every 100 from all the tribes of Israel, and 100 from 1,000, 1,000 from 10,000 to get provisions for the army. So that's basically a way to say we're going to take 10% of our troops, and they're going to be our logistics. They're going to supply the beans and the, you know, well, I guess, I don't know if they have beans in this culture, but, you know, the corn and the whatever else. I guess lentils and all the other stuff that you would think was a traditional Mideastern diet, but it's kind of interesting that it acknowledges what, you know, armies have found out through history is that logistics have to be planned for. You can't just, you know, all of a sudden run up and lay siege to a city if you don't have, I mean, if you understand, like, what was the place where all the Israelites committed suicide?
Was it Masada?
I mean, that siege lasted years. And they were up, if you saw where they were, like, up high on this hill, they had long enough for the Romans to actually build a road up to them. So a siege could last years. I don't think at this point anybody's elevated it to the level that the Romans did for sieges. And but it says, then when the army arrives at Gibeah and Benjamin, it could give them what they deserve for this outrageous act done in Israel. So they're basically saying these people deserve to die, and we're going to have people supply the army, 10% of the people. I don't know, it doesn't really give. I was thinking again how we were discussing last week about people that, you know, really don't want to fight and how that can be contagious, and real brave people can be contagious. I don't know if you would choose, like, a tribe, a particular tribe, and then take so many people out of them, or some from each tribe, which is probably more along the lines that they went. I don't know if they picked the guys and said, I really don't want to do this, you know. We would call them today conscientious objectors, and or how this, but it basically gives you the logistics of, and this is held true throughout history that, you know, as much as 10% of the military moves on logistics, and Napoleon learned that lesson, and Rome, and a whole bunch, and even the United States,
Germany,
Germany, in Russia. All right. So all the Israelites got together and united as one against the city. The tribes of Israel sent messengers throughout the tribe of Benjamin saying, "What about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now turn those wicked men of Gibeah over to us that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel." But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. This is an interesting, and it's kind of, I guess nowadays the internet has become, I remember growing up as a kid and my parents got the Sunday paper, and I remember my father sitting on the couch on Sunday morning before we would go to church, he would read the Sunday newspaper. So I guess the internet has kind of replaced, and it's, I was just reading today and some of the things about the Sound of Freedom movie, and you would think there would be no way in human, anybody, like even the craziest person can't say, you should not be messing around with 4, 5, 10, 12-year-old little kids. They should be off limits for anybody, no matter what. I mean, in my, either I'm crazy or the rest of the world is crazy, that this shouldn't even be an issue. And how many people are defending the pedophiles and the people doing this? And, you know, there's some reports out there that, I mean, this whole thing, people, not to get into political, but this all ties back to this Epstein's Island thing. How many people in our government and in the high upper echelons of society and money and stuff like this are involved in this kind of thing? For anybody to be protecting this, you know, using that as an example, because you would look at this and think, you know, even the people, even the Benjamites would be like, man, these guys are crazy. We need to deal with this. And maybe if they had stepped up and said, we'll go deal with these particular guys, it would have spared the city and spared, it would have spared a whole bunch of, but then on the other hand, you know, who's controlling all this? And there is free will, and you can make decisions, but none of these decisions everybody's making is in, you know, surprise to God. So I just think, I'm trying to, like, think about, and me and Scott had a conversation about, I think this is the case where even at the Last Supper when Jesus said, hey, somebody's going to betray me. And before they could even start fussing about who was the greatest among them, they all said, is it me, Lord? Because everybody is capable of this. We, you know, obviously have seen in our own little congregation the evil that can be visited upon people by people you wouldn't suspect. But everybody has, you know, darkness in their soul. If you let that control you, we're capable, humans are capable of unbelievable things. You know, I mean, that's how you got the death camps in Germany and, you know, all the things throughout human history, man's inhumanity to man, that we've been able, and I personally, you know, I'm really, really bad about it. When I look at what I could do to my political enemies, I'm like, they better be glad I'm not God. Everybody should be glad I'm not God, including me, right? But the things you would do to people when you're just like, how can you be this? And again, go back to Romans, and if you read Romans, the way it works is like, so you had the sexual revolution of the 60s, everybody was do what you want, you know, and then that didn't satisfy enough, so you had like the homosexual movement, that carried on, you know, all the way through. Just give us gay marriage and we'll be happy. Then it'll all be good. Well, how'd that work out for us, you know? And now God just turns you over to the base mind, and you just look for things to go deeper and deeper. And now we're into guys thinking they're women, women thinking they're men, you know, participating in sports and all this stuff. And you just look at the world just gone mad, and it's like, so on one hand, you read this in a page and you think, how can these people be so, you know, crazy and look at what they're doing? And it's like, well, stand back and look at our world. You know?
Trey, the whole book of Judges is like a preview of what the world is.
Yep. Yeah, and what we're capable of.
That's right. It's the whole book of Judges. Progression shows how progressively worse
it's going to get. And when once you lose your, you know, anchor and even like through the I know the 50s get romanticized a little bit and even the 60s, but I just remember times in school people would give the David and Goliath thing, or people would just mention that in the conversation and everybody knew what you were talking about. I don't even believe most people know. I mean, sure they've heard the term, but I don't think they know what it references back to. I don't think most, because we had a common place to start, we could communicate. We could understand references, and, you know, I mean, for whatever the forces of evil, I believe that, I mean, one of the first things you do is disconnect people from their anchor. Now you have no moral compass. You have nothing to reference. If you can't reference, I mean, I could stand here before you and say murder's bad. And you could say, no, it's not. What right do I, really, what right do I have to say it's bad? Other than this, the Word of God saying every human being on the planet is an imager of God. And if they're to be dealt with, God set up governments to deal justice. Was the only reason they're even in existence. And look how far we've, you know, come from that. But you can justify anything. And I'm terrible about it. I just, like I said, I can have terrible thoughts about what I'd like to do to people, and I can justify it with, you know, any scripture I want to. But, you know, it's just bad when this is, and we're going to see, you know. So back to, I guess the question, and I was going to save it for now, but just to let you think about this. If, I know Ruth didn't think so, but if this woman committed adultery and had been dealt with according to the law, none of this story would have happened. But a lot of people are going to die because this, the fruit of the poison tree that we talked about, that, you know, this just keeps giving fruit after fruit, and it's all corrupted, and a lot of people are going to die because of it. So I guess I stopped at verse 13. So verse 14, from their towns they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. So everybody in Benjamin, the Benjamites, came from all the other towns to protect these guys that had done this thing. And among these soldiers were the 700 selected troops. 15. At once the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from the town, in addition to 700 able young men from those living in Gibeah. Among all these soldiers were 700 select troops who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. So they were obviously really, really good. And I have to laugh if you, well, not laugh, but if you go back to the story, there's the story of the judge, Ehud, who, and the whole story is based on him being left-handed. And you wonder, you know, how this story plays into that. But being left-handed, obviously, most soldiers, I was just kind of reading up on it, so most shields were held in your left hand, obviously, and people were right-handed. So I'm expecting somebody to hit me from this side, so I have my shield here. If somebody's going to hit me from this side, my shield really doesn't protect me. So being left-handed and being really, really good left-handed is a really, really big military advantage.
We're going to show how just the left-handed people were in the past and how they've demised. I mean, you had one guy who stood out left-handed, and you had 700.
Well, again, well, you kind of missed the beginning that this this kind of gives evidence that this happened early in Israel's history, like right after they had conquered the land, because they're still able to function as a complete group, where later on and all throughout the judges, they kind of function regionally. There's never a judge that unites the whole thing. So I don't know, but most people believe this would have happened before Ehud. So I was kind of wondering, I don't know how many years ago, if the injury he had, remember he had an injury which made him left, he was left-handed, but they thought he was a cripple.
Yes.
But so you don't know if it came from something this or if it's a long time.
From how you order a book read, it's amazing how you can look at that and you can see it. It's how one left-hand person made a judgment for God.
And 20,000 are going to, yeah.
It's.
All right, verse 17. Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 swordsmen, all of them fit for battle. And Israel went up to Bethel and inquired of God, which I kind of highlighted that because it's kind of funny if you look back at the verse before, they were throwing lots, cast lots to figure out how to do things. And I guess somebody was smart enough to say, hey, let's not do any more of this before we go before God. And they said, who of us is first to go up? Who is to go up first to fight against the Benjamins? And the Lord replied, Judah shall go first. Which is kind of interesting that the Lord replied, and because it never says like the priest. I'm assuming the priest, if they did it by the, by the rules and by the way it should have been done, which I don't think maybe God wouldn't have answered them if they hadn't done it correctly. But it's kind of interesting that starting here, Judah shall go first. That this is kind of like, if you understand the 12 tribes, and Reuben was the eldest, but he had problems with his dad's concubine. Again, the concubine thing, just when that word's mentioned, it's just nothing but problems. But so here's like the first time that Judah's kind of elevated in the scripture, which, obviously we know now that out of Judah will come the Messiah. And so it says, the next morning Israel got up, and it's kind of interesting what they ask and the answer they got. So keep that in mind. The next morning Israel got up and pitched camp near Gibeah. The Israelites went out to fight the Benjamites and took up battle positions against them at Gibeah. The Benjamites came out of Gibeah and cut down 22,000 Israelites on the battlefield that day. But the Israelites encouraged one another and again took up positions where they had stationed themselves the first day. And Israel went up and wept before the Lord until evening, and they inquired of the Lord. They said, shall we go up to fight against the Benjamites, our fellow Israelites? And the Lord answered, go up against them. Again, inquired of God, got an answer. But what they inquired wasn't the complete question. And we'll see that. So then Israel drew near Benjamin the second day. This time, when the Benjamites came out of Gibeah to oppose them, they cut down another 18,000 Israelites, all who armed with the sword. Then all the Israelites, the whole army, went up to Bethel, where they sat weeping before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord. So 22,000 died the first day. So like 40,000 people have died in this. Doesn't really give you a count. I have a hard time believing no Benjamites died, but it doesn't in a thing, it doesn't tell you up to that point. And the Israelites inquire of the Lord. So they went up to Bethel, which is where the Ark of the Covenant was. And in those days, the Ark of the Covenant of God was there, with Phinehas, the son of Eleazar. Again, it goes back to the son of Aaron. So this is early, early on in Israel's history, because they're only one generation away from Aaron, and who they're inquiring of. And his son was ministering before. And they said, shall we go up and fight against the Benjamites, our fellow Israelites, or not? And the Lord responded. So they still haven't asked the right question. But the Lord's response answers a question they haven't even asked. That's all I kind of got out of this was the Lord responded, go, for tomorrow I give them into your hands. So they never had asked, will we have victory? And God had never promised them victory. And it never seemed to cross their mind that God said, yeah, go fight, but he never gave the rest of the answer, and it doesn't seem like they ever inquired. They were just so eager to go up and fight that they left the rest of that out. Then Israel set an ambush around Gibeah. They went up against the Benjamites on the third day, I think that's kind of interesting, and took up positions against Gibeah as they had done before. And the Benjamites came out to meet them, and they were drawn away from the city. They began to inflict casualties on Israelites as before, so about 30 men fell in the open field and on the roads, the one leading to Bethel and the other to Gibeah. While Benjamites were saying, we're defeating them as before, the Israelites were saying, let's retreat and draw them away from the city to the road. So it looks like here they've come up with a little better plan. You know, they were just like the frontal assaults. So God said, go fight. Here we go. You know, frontal attack, no planning. Let's go. And now this time it's a little different. God said, I've given them into your hands. And it looks like he gave them a little better strategy here in the way they're going to conduct the battle. And obviously, you know, I don't know what God, but the one thing you could think here is through the first 2 days, the Benjamites now become overconfident. And as you can see, they can't go, oh, this is going on just like we've done before. We're going to get them one more time. Then 10,000 of Israel's able young men made a frontal attack on Gibeah. The fighting was so heavy that the Benjamins did not realize how near the disaster was. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and on that day the Israelites struck down 25,100 of the Benjamites, all armed with the sword. So there was 26,700, I believe, if you go back and read the... And so there's a huge, huge portion. And it's kind of interesting that it gives you kind of this thing, and then it goes back and gives you some details on how that was accomplished. Then when the Benjamites saw they were beaten, now that the men of Israel had given way before Benjamin because they relied on ambush they had set near Gibeah. Those that had been in ambush made a... So what they basically did, they retreated. And as the Benjamites were attacking them, they were being drawn further and further away from the city. Well, there was guys who were laying in ambush, so now they have no one's defending the city, evidently. So now these guys rush into the city, and you're going to see. And said, Israelites had arranged with the ambush that they would send up a great cloud of smoke from the city, and then the Israelites would counterattack. The Benjamites had begun to inflict casualties on the Israelites, and they said, we are defeating them. So it's kind of giving you a replay of what we talked about earlier. So it says, hey, we're winning this again. We've got this. It's going to, but then they look and saw a column of smoke began to rise from the city, and the Benjamites turned and saw the whole city going up in smoke. So now we have nowhere to retreat to. We have nowhere. Again, we're talking about the logistics of battle. So now there's nothing. They have no food, no water, no shelter. They have nothing. They're just exposed on the battlefield. So the Israelites counterattacked, and the Benjamites were terrified because they realized that disaster had come upon them. And it's a kind of a piece of psychological warfare in that now, oh, wait a minute, you know, we were so self-confident a minute ago, and within seconds of seeing the smoke going up, they realize they've been had. So they fled before Israelites in the direction of the wilderness, but they could not escape the battle, and the Israelites who came out of the towns cut them down there. So I was kind of thinking about this, and again, it's tough. tough in the book to justify, like, God said, go up against them, yeah, fight against them, and, you know, 18,000 die one day and 20,000. Just Chris's opinion, there's nothing here that says that, but you're just wondering. So again, we were saying the Benjamites were protecting all the guys in Gibeah because they were all relatives and all. Well, people dying now were all relatives of the people that were fighting against the Benjamites. So now they're ready to extract revenge. Like, there's going to be no mercy, no quarter given in this deal, and you don't know how much that played into it. Like, if they had just gone up and won the first day, they might have said, okay, we got the guys that did this, and we're cool, everybody go home. But in this case, because it lasted a couple of days, and their friends died, and a lot of them, they are ready to really, really extract, and, you know, I don't read God's mind, and he doesn't answer to Chris, so it's a really interesting that how out of control this gets. They surrounded the Benjamites, chased them, and easily overran them in the vicinity of Gibeah on the east. 18,000 Benjamites fell, all of them valiant fighters. As they turned and fled towards the wilderness of the rock of Rimmon, the Israelites cut down 5,000 men along the road. They kept pressing after the Benjamites as far as Gibeon and struck down 2,000 more. And on that day, 25,000 Benjamite swordsmen fell, all of them valiant fighters. But 600 of them turned and fled into the wilderness of the rock at Rimmon, where they stayed 4 months. And the men of Israel went back to Benjamin and put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they had found, and all the towns they came across they set on fire. So here, this just spun out of, now, again, it might have been God's plan. Obviously, it was God's plan. It would have done. But they were so incensed about this whole situation. First off, what they did to the guy's concubine, and then, secondly, what they've done to their fellow tribesmen, that they just extract an unbelievable, you know, revenge, but a really, really high price of revenge on these guys, and they just destroy them. We'll see, there's going to be a real, when everybody finally dies, kind of, I don't know how everybody's into it, but the French Revolution, right, so it kind of started out like the American Revolution. It was how they wanted to throw off the king and do this. Well, they started guillotining people, and then the people that started guillotining people got guillotined by other people that got a hold of the guillotines that got guillotined by other people. The bloodlust did not stop. And there was a saying about once you start feeding the guillotine, it's a very hungry, you know, thing. And so that's the way this kind of played out, that, you know, once this city did this and these guys in this town, it just fed this fire on both sides. And, you know, it's kind of, again, it's just showing how mankind can, you know, the inhumanity that we can visit upon one another at any given moment. I know that, but I searched for, you know, other than what they did and what you can see in Romans and stuff like that in there, I don't know how to, you know, bring much more of this into, it looks like a straightaway narrative, a historical narrative that, you know, I wish you could, you know, I could make it some kind of real spiritual thing.
But
that,
you know what I think the truth is, that God used his people, that he used he judges the one group by using the other group, who also he judges and gets rid of them in this story. He gets rid of a lot of them when he lets them go twice before, and, you know, he wipes out so many of the Israelites who are fighting the Benjamites. And it's just God. Well, what's it say in the New Testament? Judgment begins first with the house of God. So I think this really is the story about God judging the whole group of them. I mean, they were all falling away.
And then, you know, and it leads to, you know, you can kind of understand the mindset of when Babylon came to conquer Israel, them saying, oh, no, we're God's people. They're never going to do anything to us. And God's like, nope, you've been really, really bad. I told you if you kept doing this, there was going to be a price to pay. And boom. So, you know, again, related to our country, you know, we look at the people that are lined against us and, you know, in my mind, how evil they are. But on the other hand, once your blinders have been removed growing up in a military family and, you know, we were very patriotic and growing up with schools taught, you know, you did the pledge, you did all this stuff. And then now to look at our country and what we've become, I mean, we export our jobs and porn. And that's it. You know, we really don't. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. If you go back to the history of World War II, I constantly read that stuff. And basically, once World War II didn't end decisively in the beginning, that was the Battle of Pearl Harbor, it became a battle of industrialization. And the United States was able to have the resources, the people, the factories, the space, the everything to just eventually out-industrialize all the other countries. You know, we eventually overtook Great Britain as the... But now, do you think it's by accident that all our manufacturing has been offshored? We couldn't produce a paper bag pretty much now if we had to. And... You know, it's by design, and it's the fall is going to be great when it comes, and it's just going to be pretty miserable for all of us. Anybody have anything to add? Any?
I think it's like being back at the beginning. It kind of goes. Remember, they were in that war mentality, right? They gave them the same options that they gave the tribes or the people who were in Canaan when they came in. If you surrender, we won't attack. Right? And so basically they did the same thing here, and there was a point where at least at that, and then you had when everybody got sent home, right? The tribes of Manasseh, half tribe, you know, all the, they built an altar, and everybody on the west side were getting ready to come in and destroy it, because what wicked thing, the same exact wording as it was used here. It was like they, at least at the beginning, even though they didn't have a judge and they didn't have these other things, and while there's still wickedness within the camp, there were those in the camp who said such wickedness should not be done and we need to follow what God said. You know what I'm saying?
Like, agreed. And it goes back.
There are points that people rose up at Israel, you know what I mean?
Right.
To deal with the wickedness. And the truth is, it's the same thing Jesus teaches, that if there's something that causes you to sin to keep you out of heaven, cut it off. You know what I mean? And to live a life that's willing to just execute wickedness in your own life. But start there first.
Right. Well, if you think about Abraham not realizing how wicked Sodom was and what he started his bargaining with God, you know, if there's 100 people there, God's like, okay, if there's 100, well, what if there's 50? You know, what if there's 20? What if there's 10? You know, and it just keeps going down. He didn't realize how wicked, and sometimes, you know.
Thought Lot did some good.
When you're living in the wickedness, when you are surrounded by it, it's very easy to, I mean, it just becomes part of it. The culture becomes part of you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can reject it, you can say, well, I really don't like that. I really don't like it. But, I mean, look at this world. You know, it didn't happen because everybody was standing up for right. You know, I mean, even as Christians, we're not saying, like, even the churches, I heard somebody, some interview about, like, in Nazi Germany, there were three, I don't know, I think it was when all of the things went down and started persecuting people within the, within Germany. 3,000 Christian churches. But of those, half of them went immediately with the state. Like, oh, yeah, well, that's good. They jumped in. It was crazy. I mean, they knew better. They had to know better. You know, they were actually godly, and, you know, people who said, okay, we'll go along with that. Yeah. You better make a better society and get rid of that group, you know. It's just crazy. And the other ones that were left, it was just such a few. such a very few that stood up, you knew what was right, and really, I mean, died for it.
Yep, and the cost was, we can say, and the cost was very high.
And cost. The thing I see is, if you look at this, in the book of Judges, how many times did all of Israel join with the judge? Did every tribe join? Did every...
No, never, hardly never after.
And this, I believe, is a start because they... Some of the people seeing what happened to the tribe of Benjamin, and it started to downfall because they felt sorry for him. And there you had, yeah, open up the end of the end, near the end of Judges tells you why the book of Judges, because Israel couldn't get together, because Israel couldn't get behind God. And it's, they, it took a, how long? The three questions, but when they first started, they weren't questioning God. You know, it's asking God, what's the plan? How do we go about doing this?
Yep.
And that, then it shows just the complete downfall of it.
Well, again, and not to give, I was going to save it for the end of the book.
Did I
but,
again?
No. But all throughout the book, it says, and Israel had no king, right? Like, that's a symptom of part of the problem. Who was the first king? Who was it?
Saul.
What tribe was he from? So there. So even once they got a king, they got it from the most corrupt tribe that, you know, but he was head and shoulders taller, and he was very handsome, so he looked like a king should look in man's eyes. So this is, so we're going to go 180 degrees to where we don't have a king and there's chaos, so we got a king, but he comes from the worst tribe. Dan does some things and Ephraim, and
but they didn't want that.
Well, the old, let's put it to you, the only tribe that got judged down to, you know, 600 guys left.
But it's amazing, and you can see God has shown us, and like you said before, it's how it's written in the book. It was a chronological watch, but it showed us the progression, and it wasn't in the order, but it doesn't have to be. It's just a progression. And once you take your focus off of God, it's going to not be good.
Yep.
It might be interesting that it is called the Book of Judges, because we see people, even though they were doing what was right or not, they're judging in the way they think should be judged.
Agreed.
They say, are you going to kill us? Are we going to wipe them out? They don't say, Lord, what do you want us to do? Their prayers are directed.
Right.
Their prayers are, we want this done. And
well,
I
you
think,
get involved.
Think,
are you going to get involved with our plan, God?
Right. And what happens most of the time?
Right.
God's people react and force out and become the judge. That they're more than those who are guilty or affected.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, well, we're going to see later that it just caused all kind of turmoil. Yes, they removed the wickedness, per se. But yet they still are all going to suffer because they got to do more wickedness and continue to rely on themselves to make it right. And that's the kind of stuff that we do all the time. Like, bless my plan. It's the children prayed and cried out, and God gave them their heart's desire and brought meekness to soul. And that's what ends up happening when we walk in judgment and get it right. There's more affected by it that had nothing to do with it. Obviously, there was only 700 from Gibeah, so that means there's only 700 people had to die. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
When we act out in our judgment, in our righteousness, we cause just as much damage as the wickedness that wicked people cause.
Anybody else? Anybody want to close with some prayer? Sure. That was, you're going to volunteer, right?
He's like, anyone?
Anybody?
Dear Heavenly Father, we put this time together, gives you the glory, and gives us a little knowledge. Because, Lord, we know we can't get enough knowledge from it. And the effect it has on people and seeing what that you're in control. We just pray in your name that you leave it that way. And we keep turning to you, Lord.
Amen.
But it's